Ecclesiastes. What a weird name for a book in the Bible. If you're like most people, even lifelong Christians, you've probably never paid any attention to this book. You've probably never studied it. You may not have ever read it. You probably don't know a lot about what's in it. It's one of those that you just kind of skip through. It's kind of like, the Habakkuk or whatever, you know, these kind of strange books. It's right in the middle of the Bible, though. It's part of what's called this wisdom literature. Okay, we've got Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon that are all called wisdom literature. And if you've gone through our Proverbs study, which as this class is being taught, we're teaching this one-week class on Ecclesiastes that follows a six-week class on Proverbs. And if you've gone through our Proverbs study, then you've learned that this wisdom literature is all Hebrew poetry. And so, like that, a lot of the book of Ecclesiastes is written in poetry. So as a result, it's an easy book to kind of skip over. It doesn't have a lot of the prayers and songs and that kind of thing of Psalms. It doesn't have, it does have some, but not, it's not filled with these little one verse snippet, Proverbs that gives you some good guidelines for living, but it's got some different stuff in there. If you have looked at it, you're probably taken off from the very beginning when it starts talking about how everything is meaningless and you know, it just seems to be a very confusing kind of book. There may be one thing that you would be familiar with, whether you've read it or not, and that is the first few verses of chapter 3. Because there was a big song in the, what was it, late 60s, early 70s, that was kind of taken from this, a popular song. So, what is it all about? Well, if you look at the heading, I'll give you the answer real quick. This book answers the question, what is the meaning of life? Okay? What is the meaning of life? We looked at the study on Proverbs. Talked about, you know, how are we to live this life that God intended for us? Well, this book says, why even bother with life? Why do we even have life? What's the meaning of it? So, let's dive in. And as we dive in, we'll learn more about why we have this book, and we'll learn more about what is the meaning of life. So, first, let's answer the question of who wrote this book. That's kind of a key question. It starts out, chapter 1, verse 1, it says, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. So the words of the teacher, so it's some teacher. But we get some clues here. It says, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Who does that sound like? Well, it sounds like a guy named Solomon, King Solomon, the one who wrote most of the Proverbs in the book of Proverbs. You know, he was the son of David, okay? He was a king in Jerusalem, and with his wisdom, he would definitely be considered a teacher. He taught about the wisdom God gave him, and so that kind of makes sense. Now, a lot of people say, well, I don't know if the writing sounds the same, and that kind of stuff is what we might think Solomon might have written. And when someone says a son of David, that doesn't mean it has to be his son. It just means a descendant of David. And so it could be some other king that reigned in Jerusalem some years later, many years later, whatever. So some aren't real sure that it is Solomon. But you know, if we look at a few other verses in the book, we see some things that even continue to point more and more towards Solomon. And this is why traditionally, and probably most scholars say that this was written by Solomon. Chapter 1, verse 12 says, I, the teacher, okay, so here the writer is speaking here, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Okay, so that right there kind of narrows the field, right? So number one, it precludes any of the kings of the northern kingdom. Okay, after Solomon, the kingdom of Israel was split into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And the kings of the southern kingdom reigned in Jerusalem, where the kings of the northern kingdom, well, they started out in a few different places, but Samaria was the main capital eventually. You know, there was Tirzah, but This was king in Jerusalem, okay? So that narrows the field to the southern kings. But on the other hand, one other thing that I kind of see is he says, I was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Well, after Solomon, the kingdom split, and the northern kingdom took the name Israel, and the southern kingdom took the name Judah. I would think that if it was one of the latter kings, someone after Solomon, they would have said, I was king over Judah in Jerusalem. But instead he says, I was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And to be honest, there's only two kings over Israel in Jerusalem. One of them was Solomon, the other one was David. And it couldn't be David because we see this was a son of David. Okay? So, that verse to me points fairly strongly towards Solomon. A couple others, verse 16, I thought to myself, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. When you think of wisdom, when you think of a king that's got a lot of wisdom, you think of Solomon, because God gave him great wisdom. He had more wisdom, we're told, in the book of 2 Kings, than anybody who had come before him, anyone after him, except for Jesus. And so here we go. I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. So that all kind of points also to Solomon. Chapter 2, verses 4 to 9. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kind of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. Okay, so he undertook great projects, many slaves, many livestock, great riches, richer than any other king before him in Jerusalem, which, besides David, there was other kings in Jerusalem before the Israelites, before David led and his soldiers and conquered Jerusalem from the Jebusites. There were other kings before them. You've heard of the name of Melchizedek. He was king of Salem, king of Jerusalem, way back in Abraham's time. And so he's saying he had more riches, more wisdom, all of that than Melchizedek and any others who ever reigned in Jerusalem. Sure sounds like Solomon to me. And then one more, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 9. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. Again, that all kind of fits with Solomon. He wrote many proverbs. In fact, this book is right after a book that contains many, many proverbs that he wrote. And it's before another book that's also kind of attributed to Solomon, the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs. And that's part of why it's sandwiched here, is because the thought is that Solomon wrote this. And he probably wrote it a little later in age, because he tells a lot about what he researched and learned through his experiences in life, which we'll see as we go on. Okay, so that's the thought, is when it talks about the teacher, that's Solomon. Okay, so Solomon is the author of this book, or the one that that when the teacher talks firsthand, it's him. Now, the word teacher that we have that is the Hebrew word koheleth. Okay, and koheleth is, it conveys more than just the word teacher. Again, Hebrew words, there aren't as many Hebrew words as there are English words, so one word has to convey more meaning. And in this case, it's got a little bit more meat. It's a teacher of a gathering or an assembly. So it's not just like a one-on-one teacher, but rather a group of people who have been gathered or assembled together for the purposes of being taught. Okay? So it's the gathering or assembly. The word in Hebrew is kahal, okay, which is part of the first part of the word koheleth. Okay? And so kahal means a gathering or an assembly. And you really see that word used when they're talking about a group of people gathered for worship or for instruction to be taught by a teacher. Hence, again, we have the kahaleth. Now, when the Old Testament was translated around 250 BC into Greek, that version was called the Septuagint. And so it translated the words, and so obviously instead of kahaleth for teacher, it's the Greek word. And a little clarification of that, let's go back even further to kahal. The kahal part, in Greek, the word for assembly or kahal is ekklesia. Okay? Ekklesia. Well, the name that the scholars who translated into Greek gave this book is Ecclesiastes. Okay, that's how we say it. Ecclesiastes, which means a member of an assembly. So it's not really, Ecclesiastes doesn't mean the teacher, it rather means someone who's listening to the teacher of the assembly. Okay, someone who's part of the assembly. That's where we get this name. That's why this is called Ecclesiastes. Weird name, but it sounds Greek to me, right? That's because it is Greek. And so that's what that is. Okay, now that we know that who wrote it and why we have this name, Ecclesiastes, let's be an Ecclesiastes. Okay? Let's sit back and let's learn. What does the teacher have to tell us? Why did the teacher write this book for us? Verse 2. Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Okay, do you get kind of a key word for the book here? The word meaningless. If you look up at the top of page one of your handout, you'll see that the key verse for this book is this verse, verse 2. Because this is the conclusion. This is what starts this whole conversation, and that's what the teacher's telling us. He's teaching us that everything is meaningless. Okay, this is a real positive sounding book, right? We hadn't heard anything yet. Let's keep going, okay? So, why did he say things were meaningless? Why did this bother him, that life is meaningless? Verse 3, what does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Okay, so we work all day, we work hard, for what purpose? Why? What do you get out of it? Okay, that's what he's wondering. Okay, it's all meaningless. Okay, verse 4. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Okay, when you look at the history of the world, you look at how long the world's been here before us, how long the world's going to be here after us, our life is negligible. Okay, man's life is fleeting. And really doesn't amount to a lot in the whole history of this creation, right? So, you know, we come and go, but the world keeps going without us, right? Number 5, the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and then turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the seas never fall. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. Okay? So, whether we have anything to do with it or not, which we don't, the earth keeps going on. Okay? The water keeps flowing to the sea, the winds keep moving round and round, the sun rises and sets, the world keeps turning, whether we're here or not. Okay? So why do we matter? That's what he's saying. It's meaningless. Our life is meaningless. Verse 8. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. Okay? So we try to understand and figure out the things of this creation, the things around us, but we can't figure it all out. And when we do understand stuff, we're never satisfied. We want to learn more. Okay? So all this great knowledge that we've learned over the years and with all our science, what good is that? We still want more. We're never satisfied. It really hasn't made a big difference in the scheme of creation, in the scheme of the universe, right? It's all meaningless. verses 9 to 10. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, here's something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. So there's nothing new under the sun. Okay? We may get excited about something that's new to us, but you know what? What's here now has been here before. There's nothing new under the sun. Verse 11. There's no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. A life has no significant impact over time. You think of how many lives there are in this world now. The billions of people. How insignificant that makes you feel. How significant can your life be when the world just keeps going with or without you? You really don't make any impact on this world. Right? So if you look at all this, what conclusion do you come to? It's what he said. Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless, utterly meaningless. He looked at all these things and he said, it just doesn't make any sense. There's got to be a meaning to our lives, right? We just can't just be nothing more than a cockroach, right? That has no impact on anything. So what did he decide to do to try to find the meaning of life? Verse 12, I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. And then skipping to 16, I thought to myself, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Okay, so what did he try to do? He tried to figure it out. He pursued wisdom and knowledge so that he could maybe come to an understanding of what is the meaning of life. Why is our life significant? Why would it be? Okay. What is the meaning of life? So, as he did this research and he took the great wisdom that God gave him and tried to come to understanding and knowledge, what did he conclude? Verse 17 to 18. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom. And also, I took the other side too, of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. After all his work, after all his study, after all his research, after all his digging into it as well as he could with the wisdom God gave him, he concluded it was just a chasing after the wind. That wisdom wasn't the answer to the meaning of life. And in fact, it could even make matters worse. That is what that last verse said. So that wasn't the answer. So what did he try next? Chapter 2. I thought in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But this also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? Okay, so he tried pleasure and laughter, having a good time. But he found that wasn't the answer either. What were some of the ways he tested that premise, tested that theory of pleasure and laughter? Verse 3. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guiding me with wisdom, I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. Okay, so he tried drinking in foolishness. Just party on, man. Let's go party on and see if that's the answer. Okay. Another way he tried, verse 4 through 6, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. So he built stuff. He tried to see if maybe that's what we're about, is building things and making things that would last beyond us or whatever. He built houses, he built vineyards, he built gardens, he built parks, he built irrigation. Next, verse 7 through 9, he says, I bought male and female slaves, and I had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amass silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. Okay? So he pursued great riches. Okay? Slaves, livestock, money, entertainers, harem, all of those things. He pursued great riches. And he had great riches. Okay? You see that in 2 Kings and elsewhere. God richly, richly blessed Solomon. Verse 10. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. Okay? So everything his eyes desired, he got. He could afford it. He could do it. He was a king, right? So he went for everything. So, with all these things that he tested, what did he conclude from this pursuit? Verse 11. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done, and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Okay, with all this stuff he did, these great construction projects, these great pleasurable things that he did for himself, it was meaningless. It didn't have any impact on this world, this creation, on anything under the sun. It really didn't matter. If everything's meaningless, is there any difference then between living wisely or in foolish pleasure? You know, he tried foolishness, but he said, I kept my wisdom with me, you know, so he never kind of went totally foolish. Maybe we should just go totally foolish if it really doesn't matter, if it's all meaningless. Verses 13 to 14, he says, well, I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them all. Okay? So it is better, wisdom is better than folly, but in the end, both of them are meaningless in the long run. Okay? So the answer to the meaning of life isn't wisdom, it isn't folly, it isn't pleasure. Okay? So, after he had researched these things, after he had come to this conclusion that all is meaningful or meaningless, how did he feel? Verse 17. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it's meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Of course, if you take such a pessimistic look at life and you conclude that it's meaningless, that everything is meaningless, well, then what's the purpose, right? So he hated life because it was meaningless. And that's what he concluded is the human situation. He goes on then, what makes the situation worse? Verse 18, I hated all the things that I had toiled for under the sun. He worked pretty hard to do all these things, and yet it was meaningless, right? And he hated them because, he said, what makes it worse is I must leave them to the one who comes after me. When I'm gone, I can't take those with me. So they're going to go to the one who comes after me. And who knows, verse 19, whether he'll be a wise man or a fool. Yet he'll have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. Okay? All that he worked for, all this great stuff that he built and the things he put in place, they could all be undone quickly by a foolish son. Okay, he has to pass that on, and it could all be wasted by his descendants. So, again, it's all meaningless. He has no way of guaranteeing any kind of lasting impression, any kind of lasting impact that he's made on the world, on creation, on the universe. So, why do we work hard? What do we achieve from all the hard work and the effort of our lives? Verse 22, what does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labors under the sun? All his work is pain and grief. Even at night his mind doesn't rest. This too is meaningless. So what do you get for all this hard work? Nothing. Just pain and grief and sleepless nights. It's all meaningless. Okay? You're kind of wondering by now, okay, why is this in the Bible? This is a pretty negative sounding kind of thing. This is a pretty pessimistic kind of thing, right? It's like, okay, I came in here feeling good, but now you've got me a little depressed about why is my life important, right? Well, but he did make some positive conclusions. And this is really what the purpose of the book is about. Let's look at this. Verses 24 to 25, he says, you know, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? That's the bottom line. That's the conclusion of what he found. Okay, so we could finish a study right now, right? Because that was what he learned. Okay, it is meaningless without God. But with God, life can be a joy. Okay, and that's what life really is about. Life without God is meaningless. If there's nothing else other than this life, that's a pretty sad situation, right? It's a pretty depressing situation because that aspect is meaningless. But this life, we have these lives. God gave us this life so that we can enjoy it with Him. So we should enjoy it. So why is a relationship with God so important? Verse 26. To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. Well, this too is meaningless, a chasing after the winds. Okay? So God blesses those who love him. Those who don't love him end up with meaningless lives. Because there is no other meaning you can add to life. Okay? God gives blessings of wisdom and knowledge and happiness to those who live in a daily, continual, right relationship with Him. Okay? It's this fullness of life. If you went through the study on Proverbs, it's exactly what Solomon was saying back there too. Okay? That's what life is about. It's to be enjoyed. It's to receive and experience and enjoy that fullness of life that God intended for us to have. So, bottom line then, what is the purpose of life? Well, Paul put it very well in Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10. Now, you may be familiar with Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9, you know, which remind us that it's by grace we've been saved through faith, not because of works. But that then feeds on into verse 10 that says, because we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works which God prepared in advance for us to do. God created us on purpose because He has stuff that He wants us to do. He has good works that He's already prepared, and all we have to do is walk in them. As we live our lives with Him in a right relationship with Him, looking to Him for His direction and guidance, that's what we saw in Proverbs is called the fear of the Lord. By turning control over to Him, then we walk in those good works. We accomplish what He wants us to accomplish, but we receive the fullness of life that He intends for us to have through this kind of a life. That is the meaning of life. That is the purpose of life, is to live the lives that God intended us to live, lives that He created us to live. Okay? To be the kind of people that He wanted us to be. All right. Well, that's the end of the study, right? Okay, that gives us the thing. Well, he then goes on. Okay, he pretty well raises the problem and answers gives a conclusion and understanding there in the first two chapters. And that's what we've seen. Well, there's 12 chapters in this book. So what's in the other chapters? Well, it's, to be honest, it's just kind of further elaboration that helps us understand that a little bit deeper and look at some of the nitty-gritty details of how that applies to our real lives. Okay? Chapter 3, we get into a section here that may be it's probably the most popular and most well-known part of the book of Ecclesiastes, and you'll recognize it as we get into it. But if we don't look at it from the perspective of the 60-70 song that came from it, but rather look at it from the perspective of what Solomon's trying to teach us about the meaning of life, he's just told us that our life, that the purpose of our lives is to enjoy the lives that God has prepared for us to live as we live it with Him. So, as we do so, how has this timeless God put some things in place for the lives that He's given us? Chapter 3, verse 1. There's a time for everything, and there's a season for every activity under heaven. Okay, so there's a time for everything, and there's a season for every activity under heaven. So the God that created us, the God that created this creation, this universe, this world, He put a lot of structure in it. That's what science is understanding some of that structure that God put in place. And likewise, He made a structure that gives us a dimension of time. And in that time, our lives fit in that time, and in that time there is a season, there is a time for everything that happens and everything that goes on under heaven. So what are some of those times? Verses 2 to 8. There's a time to be born and a time to die. There's a time to plant and a time to uproot. There's a time to kill and a time to heal. There's a time to tear down and a time to build up. There's a time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. There's a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love. A time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. What do you see in that? There's a wide range, right? You've got opposite extremes that are mentioned, and there's a time for all of this. There is a time for the good stuff, the time to be born and to plant and to heal and to build and to laugh and to dance and to gather stones and to embrace and all these things. There's time for those good things. But you know what? There's also time for the bad things. A time to die. A time to uproot. A time to kill. A time to tear down. A time to weep. A time to mourn. Okay? Our lives have all of those times. We live in a world that has all those times, and that's part of our life. As we live in the structured time that God has given us, we're going to experience good and bad. But despite that, the way we look at our lives, we could dwell on the bad, or we could dwell on the good, but how should we really understand this life in such a wide range of time? Verse 11, He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Even the bad stuff can be beautiful. Okay? So that's part of what we do in life, is to find the beauty in all aspects of life. So are we constrained by these times? Is this all that we have? And this is kind of a key thing, the second half of that verse. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Okay? So as we are God-related, as we have right relationships with God, then we're not constrained by the times here. We have all of eternity, even though we don't quite understand it. Okay? We don't quite understand anything beyond our finite life, because that's all we've experienced, but we have forever with God. But even though we have eternity, we don't quite understand it. All we know is this finite life. So what should we do with that? How are we to live in these times of life that we do know? 12 to 13. I know that there's nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live. That everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil, this is the gift of God. With a little bit of time, for, you know, I call it a little bit because it is little compared to all of eternity, the little bit of time that we have here on earth in this life, what do we do with it? God wants us to eat, drink, be happy, enjoy it, enjoy life with him. Okay? Be happy and do good. Live the lives that God has prepared you to live. Enjoy that. But we're living in this tough time, and there's some frustrations in living in these times. Verse 16. And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. So the problem, as we try to enjoy this life, is life isn't fair. Justice doesn't always win. Wickedness wins sometimes, right? You've seen it. You've experienced it. It isn't fair. So does that mean God doesn't care? You know, that he's off in eternity and doesn't really care about us with these lives here? Verse 17. I thought in my heart, well, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed. Yes, God does care. And there will be a time for judgment. God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked. There is a time for every activity, but those bad activities will be judged. Or does that mean that we just need to be patient and wait for God's justice, and then everything will be better? Verse 19. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything is meaningless. So it's not a matter of being patient because we have these finite lives. Our lives are going to end. Okay? Unless Christ comes before we die. But these lives have an end on this sin-filled earth. And as long as we're on this sin-filled earth, we're not going to see that justice fully played out. That justice will be played out in eternity beyond this life. So we won't see it here. So it's not a matter of being patient and waiting for God's justice. So does that mean then that we should instead focus our time and energy, focus our attention on the future time when God's justice will prevail? 21:22. Solomon says, who knows if the spirit of man rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth? So I saw that there's nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that's his lot. For who can bring him to see what's going to happen after him? The point that Solomon's making here is we can't see beyond these finite lives. So why focus on them? What do you know about, how can you know what's going to happen after you? When we're gone, then we'll get to see that stuff. But while we're here, we don't get to see what's on the other side of this life. So don't focus on it. Instead, focus on and enjoy the life that God has given you right now. God wants us to enjoy this life now rather than focusing all of our attention and ignoring the joy that he has for us in this life and focusing all our attention on what the future holds that we cannot see, we cannot conceive of really from this vantage point. Okay? So, we are to enjoy this life. How easy is that to do? Chapter 4. Again, I looked and I saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. You know, but better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not yet seen the evil that's done under the sun. Again, a pretty pessimistic look, but his point is that the evil and the oppression that exists in this sinful world makes it difficult to enjoy this life. This life is made very difficult because of the times in which we live, because of the evil, the wickedness, the oppression that we live in and sometimes participate in, right? So if we're going to enjoy this life through what we do, how do we do that? How do we, should we work as hard as we can and be productive as we can, like he had all those building projects, and just work and enjoy that, if enjoying our work is the right thing to do? Verses 4-6. And I saw that all labor and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. You know, better one hand with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Solomon's answer is no. We're not to focus all our energy on work. Okay? We're also not to ignore work. Okay? There's a level of work that we can enjoy, that God made us to enjoy. We're not to fold our hands back like the fool and do nothing, but we're also not to focus our entire lives on work. Okay? Better focus one hand with tranquility, with peace, to have the enjoyment that God gave us. So work with all your might for the amount that God made you to work, but don't dedicate your whole life to work. Okay? Now, how do we best find enjoyment in this life if it's not from putting our entire selves into our work? Verses 9 through 12. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. You know, also, if two lie down together, they can keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. You know, a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. What he's saying here is to really enjoy life is we don't do it alone. God made us relational creatures. He made us want to be with other people and other people to want to be with us. Okay, we talked about this when we talked about friends in the study on Proverbs. So to best enjoy life, you go through life with someone else, with others, and enjoy one another. You share God's love with one another and make sure that God is part of that. That's what that last part says. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Yourself, your friend, and God. Three strands. Okay? So that's how we enjoy this life. We don't enjoy this life by being the fool and focusing on pleasure and not working, because work is to be enjoyed. But we also do not enjoy this life by only working and by focusing all of our attention on working. Instead, we're to spend time loving and sharing God's love with one another. And that's how we get fullness of life. Okay? All right, he then goes in, and we'll just kind of zoom through chapters 5 through 11, because what you'll see, and if in fact as you kind of turn back to some of the later chapters, chapters 10 and 11, for example, you got a bunch of Proverbs, okay? He didn't get them all out in the book of Proverbs. In fact, there are thousands and thousands of Proverbs that Solomon wrote. We only have a small part of them. But he gives us, in this section, from 5 through 11, he gives us some guidelines for life, okay? Some of these kind of sound like random thoughts, but they're all things that he felt were important to tell us about how to enjoy this life that God has given us. How to have meaningful lives based on life with God, based on the enjoyment that God's got for us. And he starts out from that basis. Okay, the first few verses, we'll just read a couple parts of it. Verse 1 and the second part of verse 7. He says, "Guard your steps when you go up to the house of God. Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who don't know what they do wrong." Then verse 7, "Therefore, stand in awe of God." Okay? Stand in awe of God. When we studied the book of Proverbs, what did we call that? We called that fear of the Lord, right? Fear of the Lord. And does fear of the Lord and does standing in awe of God mean that you're afraid of Him and shaking in your boots? No. It's a reverence, an awe, a respect. It's recognizing that God is sovereign. God is omnipotent, omnipresent. God is in control of all things, including you, including me. And our tendency is to put ourselves in control of our destiny. But once we realize that God is in control and we turn that control over to Him, that's when we get wisdom. That's when we get fullness of life. That's when we get enjoyment of life. Okay? So He starts us out with these guidelines by saying, stand in awe of God. Okay? Guard your steps when you're around God. Give Him the awe, the respect, the reverence that He deserves, recognizing that He's in control. Give Him the control of your life. He then goes on to say something else that sounds pretty similar because Jesus took what Solomon said and elaborated on it. You can see what Jesus said in Matthew 5, but let's look at what Solomon said first here, verses 4 to 5. He says, when you make a vow to God, do not delay in fulfilling it. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It's better not to vow than to make a vow and not fulfill it. Don't let your mouth lead you into sin. Okay? So, he says, keep your promises. If you make a promise to God, you better keep it. Better yet, don't even make any deals with God. Don't make a promise to God. Because when you make a promise to God, what are you actually doing? Why are you making a promise to God? You're trying to make a deal with Him. God doesn't want to make deals. He's already got the deal. Okay? God already has the deal, and He wants us to live in that deal. Jesus said that. Matthew 5, in His Sermon on the Mount, we'll read verses 33 to 37. He says, again, you've heard it said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths that you've made to the Lord. But I tell you, don't swear at all, either by heaven, because that's God's throne, or by earth, because it's His footstool, or even by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great King. Do not swear by your head, because you can't make even one hair white or black. Just, look, simply, just let your yes be yes, and your no, no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one because you're trying to make a deal with God. Bottom line, don't make vows. But if you do, you better keep it. So he starts us out with these guidelines for life and focusing on our dealings with God, our relationship with God. Again, it's all based on fear of the Lord, which is a key theme that we saw when we studied the book of Proverbs. Okay, well, those people who look at this life as all there is, okay, that don't have a relationship with God, don't see eternity, don't see anything beyond this life, their lives are meaningless, right? So what do a lot of them look at to find meaning in their lives? Verse 10 says, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. So many of these people try to chase after wealth. They see that as being the purpose of this life. Let's get as much as I can get, okay? But that doesn't satisfy. That's not a meaningful purpose of life, okay? You see over and over again these rich people who just have dead lives because they're focused on money being their God, okay? How does that differ from those who put their trust in the eternal God? Verses 18 through 20. Then I realized that it's good and proper for a man to eat and drink, and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life that God's given him. For this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is the gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. So God blesses those who live in a relationship with Him with a peace that passes all understanding, right? A peace that enables them to enjoy what they have, whether it's much or whether it's little. God gives us a peace, a satisfaction that we cannot satisfy on our own by pursuing things of this world. But God gives us a satisfaction. He gives us a joy of life as we live our lives with Him and we find satisfaction and we find enjoyment in the things that we do and in the great gifts that God gives us, the things we eat, we drink, and that we enjoy. So, should we work hard now, okay, to get some stuff and sacrifice now so that we can enjoy those things later in the future? Okay, so let's work hard now, and then we don't have to worry about having to work hard later because we'll have the stuff and be able to enjoy that later. He talks about that because that's kind of a common earthly thing to do, right? Verse 2, chapter 6, God gives a man wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing in his heart desires, but God doesn't enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil. Okay, you've seen that. People work so hard to get something, and then they die, or it's stolen. Okay, that just seems wrong, right? If that's what they were putting their trust in, if that's what they were basing the meaning of their lives on, that's a sad situation. Verse 12, for who knows what is good for a man in life during the few and meaningless days that he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he's gone? God does not want us to work and store stuff up and then worry and enjoy them later. No, he wants us to enjoy them now. Enjoy them as God blesses you with these blessings, or you might miss your chance. Again, who knows when they're going to die? Who knows that, you know, and Jesus even talked about that. He talked about, you know, you can store all this stuff up and a thief can come in the night and you don't have any of that. So who knows what could happen? So enjoy the life that God's given you now. Don't focus on work now and plan to enjoy later, because you may not even have the chance then later. So, going on, chapter 7 then. As we put our trust in God, as we live righteously in a right relationship with Him, as we make Him the boss, okay, give the control over to Him, which He already has a control, will God then make our lives straight and free of troubles? He talks about that. Verse 13. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what He has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, a man cannot discover anything about his future. Okay? Point that Solomon's making here is we're going to have good times and we're going to have bad times in this life. Okay? The normal tendency is to enjoy the good times and to fret over and worry about and get stressed out over the future during the bad times. But Solomon says you're going to have good times, you're going to have bad times. God's made them both. God's in control. If you're trusting God to be in control, well, then trust Him in the bad times as well as the good times and find joy in all of it, because it's all from God. Find joy in all of it. Well, will it be better if we focus on being as good as we can? Okay, if we're just as perfect and use God's wisdom as much as possible. If not, well, then why bother being righteous? Should we just ignore righteousness? Verses 15 to 18. In this meaningless life of mine, I've seen both of these. A righteous man perishing in his righteousness, and a wicked man living long in his wickedness. Look, don't be over righteous. Neither be over wise. Why destroy yourselves? But on the other hand, don't be over wicked. And do not be a fool. Why die before your time? It's good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. The man who fears God will avoid all extremes. So he says, you don't focus on being perfect. You don't focus on being wicked. You live your life the way God's given it to give. Okay? Avoid extremes. Instead, God wants us to enjoy what we have. If you focus and you drive yourself to any one of these things, you're not going to be enjoying what God has given you. So if we're to avoid all extremes, then what should we focus on? I mean, if you focus on anything, then that's kind of an extreme, right? Because you're focusing on it. So what should we focus on in this life? Verse 15 of chapter 8. So I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany him in his work all the days of the life that God has given him under the sun. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? We've read the same thing over and over again, and he says it over and over again because that's the conclusion. What are we to focus on? Well, if you feel like you have to focus on anything, focus on your life with God, enjoying life with God, enjoying the life that God has given you. He wants us to enjoy this life. Do it, okay? What are some examples? He then gives us a number of examples in chapter 9 on how we can enjoy this life that God has given us. Verse 7, go, eat your food with gladness. Drink your wine with a joyful heart, because it's now that God favors what you do. Okay? So, enjoy what God's given you. Celebrate each day and enjoy the bounty that God's given us. Okay? Enjoy today. Verse 8. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Okay, what is that talking about? Well, that's talking about getting all dressed up and spiffed up and you know those, how good you feel about yourself and how good you feel about the times that you get, you have some big event, you have something big in your life and you get all dressed up and your hair's all perfect. That's what he's saying there. Treat each day that way. Value each day as you value the times that you get all spiffed up. Verse 9. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God's given you under the sun, all of your meaningless days, because this is your lot in life and your toilsome labor under the sun. Okay? Enjoy your time with your spouse, with your family, with those that God has given to you. And what we say before, a big part of enjoying this life is to share the love of God with others. Okay? That's how you can enjoy this life. Verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Because in the grave where you're going, there's neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. Okay? So whatever you want to do, do it. Whatever you're doing, do it with all your might, because you're not going to get to do it after this life. Right? So do it now and enjoy what you do. And I like the way Paul puts this. In fact, this is my personal favorite verse. And it's 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31. And Paul says, so whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Okay, very similar to what Solomon said here. Do it with all your might, but don't do it for your glory. Do it for God's glory. Do it for the glory of God. Okay, so whatever you do, do it with all your might to the glory of God. And then verse 12, moreover, no man knows when his hour is going to come. As fish are caught in a cruel net or birds trapped, taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly on them. Okay? His point here is, no man knows when his hour will come, so enjoy life today. Who knows what tomorrow holds? There may not be a tomorrow for you or me. We don't know that. So enjoy life now. Don't put off the joy of life that God's got in store for you any longer. Enjoy it now. Okay, we're going to skip a lot of chapters 10 and 11 because they're just filled with proverbs and they would be great to go through and read some of those. But we don't have a lot of time, right? We're probably running... Well, in fact, we're over an hour now. So I'll let you go read through those some yourselves. But he's got some nice proverbs here that help talk about how to live this life with meaning in terms of living the life that God intends us to have and enjoying that life. And then he wraps it all up in verse 8. You can actually read verses 7 to 10. But verse 8, he says, however many years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. But let him remember the days of darkness, because they're going to be many. Everything to come is meaningless. So don't worry about the future. Okay? Enjoy life today. However many years you live, enjoy all of them. Don't look forward to the years that you're going to enjoy, but enjoy the life that you have now. Why? I mean, shouldn't we spend our younger years working hard so that we can enjoy life in our latter years? So that, you know, really the time to enjoy life is after we retire and we don't have to work, right? No, he's told us many times that a big part of enjoying life is enjoying the work that we do, right? So, but our tendency here in American life, at least, is to think, okay, we work all our lives and earn up a retirement, and then I'll enjoy it then. What does he have to say about that? Chapter 12. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach when you'll say, I find no pleasure in them. Okay? He says, enjoy life now. Whatever age you are, especially if you're young, enjoy life now, because if you wait till later, pleasures may not be as easy to come by. When you're younger, it's a lot easier to do the things you want to do and enjoy the things you want to enjoy. But when you're older, you may not be able to enjoy those things. You may not be able to access that some of those. And he then goes on into a very curious, interesting poem here in verses 2 through 7. Okay? It says, and I'll start back at verse 1 again. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you'll say, I find no pleasure in them. These are the days before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. When the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop. When the grinders cease because they're few and those looking through the windows grow dim. When the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades. When men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint. When men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets. When the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along, and desire is no longer stirred. Then man goes to his eternal home, and mourners go about the streets. Remember him. Remember God. Before the silver cord is severed, or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring, or the wheel broken at the well, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. What is all of that? Okay, remember, this is Hebrew poetry. There's a whole lot of symbolism in a lot of Hebrew poetry. Now, we really haven't encountered that much in this book so far, but now we really encounter it. And in fact, this is a phrase, if you ever take the Bethel Bible class, this is a section that's used to help you see some of the allegory that the Bible has and help you understand recognizing the importance of context and to help you understand things. So what's the context here? Well, we saw that in the first verse. Remember God and live your life that God wants you to live when you're young. Before the troubles of old age come. What are some of those troubles? Well, let's go through some of these things, okay? Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark, okay? What's that? Death, okay? After you die, there is no more sun and light and moon and stars. They're gone to you, right? Or you're gone to them. So before death. Okay, the next verse, when the keepers of the house tremble, okay, the keepers of the house, the old men, the elders, tremble. They shake with old age, okay, before you are old and shake with old age. And strong men stoop, okay, you lean over, older people are not able to stand upright and walk upright, and so you get strong men stoop. When the grinders cease, because they are few. What's that? You probably get that now. Teeth. Okay? When you stop chewing because you don't have many teeth. Those looking through the windows grow dim. Okay? Right. The eyes fail. Okay? The eyes fail. When the doors to the street are closed. Okay, what is that? When the doors to the street are closed. Constipation. Okay, constipation. And the sound of grinding fades. Well, we saw grinders before, so the sound of grinding, the sound of chewing fades, so they mainly eat soft foods because they don't have teeth to be able to eat the hard foods, right? When men rise up at the sound of birds. I'll tell you, that's happening to me. I get up a lot earlier than I want to. Okay, I would just wake up. You wake up early. Okay. But all their songs grow faint. Okay, you wake up at the sound of birds, but you don't really hear their songs because your ears are failing. Ears fail. Hearing goes. When men are afraid of heights, okay, can't reach for things. And if you try to climb up on something, you may fall, so you're afraid of that. And afraid of dangers in the streets. Okay, tripping hazards and stepping over things and stepping down from steps and things like that. Tripping hazards. When the almond tree blossoms, Have you ever seen an almond blossom, almond tree blossom? It's white. This is the gray hair, okay? When hair turns gray. And the grasshopper drags himself along, okay? Where a person may have been spry before, now they're slow moving. And desire is no longer stirred. Desire is no longer stirred. There's no sexual desire. Okay. So what kind of picture is that painting? You know, that's old age. And then you have, it goes on, then man goes to his eternal home and mourners go about the street. Okay. The dust returns to the ground from where it came. The spirit returns to God. So in the old age, yes, you may not be working, but you'd probably prefer to have the ability to and have the energy to and have all the things that are falling apart on a body at that age. Okay? So, remember God in the days of your youth before all these troubles start happening. Don't wait. Don't put off your relationship with God. God has some great things in store for your life and wants to share those with you and just wants you to come to Him and live your life with Him, and He will fill you and fill your life with those things. Okay? So, it really is a positive book, right? It starts out pretty darn negative, pretty darn depressing, but when you really get to the point of it, that's what it's all about. That's what this book of Ecclesiastes is about. That's what the teacher wants to teach us, is that life is about living life with God and enjoying the great life that God has prepared for us. Okay? Now, at the end here in chapter 12, he then concludes things and then kind of gives us a summary conclusion here. He reminds us what started this entire discussion. Verse 8, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless, okay? So without God, this life has no meaning, okay? Without God, this life has no meaning. Why was the teacher, this teacher, Solomon, how was he qualified to be able to discuss that, to be able to answer that question, be able to raise that question and answer it? Next verses, 9 to 10. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. Okay? This teacher, whether you're Solomon or not, was proven wise and was very careful in what he wrote. If it's Solomon, which I think it is, you take a look at 2 Kings, what it talks about Solomon, and even elsewhere, like what we saw in Proverbs. He was the wisest man, and he was more than anyone qualified to research and answer us on the meaning of life. So, now that we've got this, his conclusions here, his understanding of the meaning of life, should we continue to research this? Should we continue to dig into it? 11 to 12. The words of the wise are like goads. Their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. You know, of making many books, there's no end. And much study wearies the body. The point he's making here is, You could keep digging. You could write more and more books on this topic and more books on this subject, but you're really not going to get any further than what I've just told you. Okay? This is it. This is what life is all about. So, what is life all about? What's the bottom line? Verse 13. Now, all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Okay? Fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. In other words, fear God, have the fear of God, which we talked about in the book of Proverbs when we studied it. That means recognize that God is in control, give Him that control, and then live with Him. That is the duty of man. And as you do, God will bless you greatly. He will give you great joy, joy that no one can take from you. Okay? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, gosh, we thank and praise you for having Solomon think through and figure out these things about the meaning of life. So many times we get caught up in it. We try to make it a lot more complicated and difficult than it is, but it's very easy. And you've made it easy because you love us. All you want with us is a relationship based on love. You already have endless, countless, great love that we can't even imagine for us. And we thank and praise you for that. You just want us to love you back. You just want us to live in a loving relationship with our Heavenly Father. Forgive us for the times that we don't. Continue to empower us and guide us and prod us with your Spirit to move us into that kind of a relationship with you so that we can enjoy you, enjoy the life that you have prepared for us. Thank you. We praise you in Christ's name. Amen.